Welcome to the Florida Roundup this week on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, a proposed new Citizens Amendment could be on the ballot for Florida voters in 2020. It would replace two words in the state constitution with one word. Instead of saying every citizen can vote, the amendment would say that only a citizen can vote. Now, this is being worked on even though it's already illegal for non-citizens to vote.
Yeah, there's a group called Florida Citizen Voters, which has raised more than $4.6 million and gotten double the number of signatures they need to put the measure on the ballot next year. Now, we'll go to your phone calls and questions about this in a few minutes. Do you support this kind of constitutional amendment? Do you see this as unnecessary given the language that's already in the Florida Constitution and federal law? And what about the process that's being used here and the money, the dark money, the questionable, curious money that's behind this kind of effort? 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800 or on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
So many questions about this, and we're not the only one that was curious. Reporter Amy Gardner of the Washington Post has been digging into the proposed Citizens Amendment for Florida. I spoke with her about it yesterday. Amy Gardner, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Now, as you report in the Post, there's a whole network of out-of-state actors, political consultants, activists, secret donors, working to change the Florida Constitution to state that only citizens may vote in elections. What prompted your interest in this story, given that it's already illegal for a non-citizen to vote in an election?
Well, that fact is actually what prompted my interest. There had been some coverage in Florida newspapers and television stations, radio stations, of this proposed amendment because it had gotten surprisingly large numbers of signatures, qualifying it for the Supreme Court review that, as you know, is required process when you're going to get a ballot initiative onto the ballot. But the fact that the powers that be in Florida, Republican and Democratic, say that it's already illegal to vote made me wonder whether there were other motives in, at root here, and also made me want to know who's behind it and where the money for it was coming from.
And what did your reporting discover?
I found that a man named John Loudon, who lives in West Palm Beach, Florida, and his wife, Gina Loudon, are the main spokespersons for this effort. And John Loudon is the chairman of the political committee that is sponsoring the ballot initiative. But I also found that John is working with a number of out-of-state political operatives who are behind the effort. A gentleman by the name of Tim Mooney from Arizona, who has worked on numerous typically conservative ballot initiatives in numerous states across the country, is actually the sort of mastermind of this effort. He set up the political committee. He also set up the nonprofit 501c4 organization that is financing the effort. And that whole setup is in place so that the actual donors can remain secret, because 501c4 organizations do not have to disclose where they get their money. So, what I found out actually were in some ways more questions than answers.
Now, it's become more difficult here in Florida to get a petition amendment like this on the ballot. The supporters of this ballot initiative say they're collecting nearly twice the amount of signatures they need to qualify for the 2020 ballot next year. So, working overtime to make sure this gets on the ballot. What would be the benefit? Who would benefit the most, do you think, from this kind of citizen voting amendment?
Well, there are a couple of different theories out there. One is that, and this has been tried in Florida in the past with other proponents of ballot initiatives, one theory is that getting a ballot amendment onto the ballot for 2020 that is of related to a topic that's very high interest, as the issue of immigration, of course, is in Florida and elsewhere, will gin up support among voters to get out and vote. And that, in turn, could help President Trump win Florida in his reelection effort next year. The other theory is that it's, political operatives making money. the nonprofit that is financing this effort has already raised, according to its public filings in Florida, almost $5 million to the political committee. And a huge amount of that money has gone to pay for the operation. There are political operatives preparing a ground game to get the ballot measure approved next year. There are millions of dollars that were spent on the signature gathering effort, which actually ended. There's two different theories there about what this could actually be doing.
Well, we appreciate you giving your insights. Amy Gardner of The Washington Post, thanks for joining us.
Happy to. Thank you.
Your calls on this citizen's petition, the process here coming up, 305-995-1800, at Florida Roundup is the handle on Twitter. Have you participated in petition signature drives in the past? What's your experience been? What can you share with us at 305-995-1800? 1800. Republican State Representative James Grant helped get legislation passed recently that makes it more difficult for these types of ballot measures to go before the voters here in the Sunshine State. He's with us now from our sister station in Tampa, WUSF. Representative Grant, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thank you for your time today. Does this particular initiative follow the spirit of your legislation?
Well, I think the spirit of the legislation was to be issue agnostic. I happen to believe that a constitution should behave like a constitution. I happen to believe that we should operate like a republic, irrespective of the issue being posed. And so what I would say is that when I filed the legislation last year to try and protect and preserve our constitution from dark money, from questions about who's funding, who's working, who's signing, who's collecting, mm-hmm. in an effort to let Floridians know that language as sacred as something going into our Florida Constitution shouldn't be an issue of out-of-state interest, of dark money, of questions of whether or not the petitions are validly signed and collected. And so I quite frankly thought naively in retrospect that when I filed that legislation, it would be a very bipartisan issue in the sense that some of my progressive and liberal friends and colleagues would say, hey, I don't want Charles Koch or the Koch brothers funding a constitutional amendment, mm-hmm. something they're not going to be governed by. And simultaneously, you have conservatives that don't want George Soros or Tom Steyer. And so the spirit of the legislation was to look at the fact that the Constitution should operate like a constitution, and that people shouldn't be playing political games with our Constitution.
Does this proposed amendment process, the citizen's amendment, is that playing games with the process in your estimation?
Well, I want to be careful how I answer this, Tom, because it's a fair question, but I think it's important for the listeners and everybody to understand that when we reformed the process, we did not undo behaviors that were already underway. So things like the minimum wage, things like the assault weapons ban, things,
sure.
those things that have already been collected. We didn't change the law with respect to anything that was already being done. What I would say is that finding no real substantive reason this language needs to be there. I think both parties have been complicit in using constitutional amendments to gen turnout, and I just believe that a constitution is so sacred it should not be a playground
gotcha.
For political
we
games.
Hear your representative, and I'll ask you about the merits of this particular question, but the process matters here because your legislation changed the process. It dealt with the process about how citizen signature-driven petitions wind up on the ballot and some of the requirements that those efforts have to go under. And so as one of the architects of that legislation, which is now in state law in Florida, what you understand about the process regarding this citizen's amendment, does it hold muster with the process that you put in place with your legislation?
Tom, and I want to be clear, I'm not trying to avoid your question. The reason I'm demarcating between previous to the legislation and post, and maybe I can rephrase your question and see if we're talking about the same thing here. I think what this does show is validate the need for last year's legislation and even more. Because the fact that we're having a question about who is funding a change to our Constitution on something so significant as voting rights, the fact that we don't all know that out in the open with complete transparency is a massive problem. The fact that we don't know who collected those petitions, whether they're Florida residents, what was being told, how they were being paid,
yeah.
the fact that we don't know that is the very reason and the
you
essence
see that as,
for
as
that
the
legislation.
Essence of the issue. It's 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup as we talk with Republican State Representative James Grant about a curious proposed citizens amendment that could go before all of you, the Florida voters, next year. Lots of tweets coming into this show, Representative Grant. Here's one. Federal investigators recently disclosed that Russian hackers breached election networks in two Florida counties in 2016. How exactly is this new Citizens Amendment more important than addressing Russian hacking directly? So many concerns in Florida about the security of our vote. And this is a very prominent one. And so what's your response to that listener?
Well, I think the listener is assuming that I think that this citizen petition initiative is more important than a foreign geopolitical foe meddling in our elections or in society writ large. And I would be happy to talk to that individual or anybody else because that just isn't an accurate assumption. The integrity of our elections, the integrity of our Constitution are the baseline and fundamental components of a republic. And so there's a lot that I could kind of rabbit trail on when it comes to, quite frankly, the state's failure when it comes to data governance and an enterprise architecture to ensure that we can have meaningful cybersecurity legislation. What I will tell that listener and everybody else is this administration and I have been working very, very closely. I do expect to finally kind of have an administration that takes seriously data governance, our vulnerabilities, the reality in a ransomware world where we have people seeking to do us real and systemic harm is that we as a state
you
can't
see
right
that,
now.
You see that as more important than making sure non-citizens can't vote, which is already against the law. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, I think if somebody's trying to play games in the Constitution to gin up political turnout, that is inherently, not only do I think it's far less significant, I don't even think it's relevant to the political discourse in contrast to a geopolitical foe that meddled in the 2016 election that intends to meddle again. And I would point that listener or anybody else to the conversation I had around the language that ended up in House Bill 5. I was mocked by some of my colleagues across the aisle for suggesting that the Russians would want to play in our election. And it wasn't long after that we found out the Russians had tried to hack at least two counties. If we cannot agree as Americans, regardless of our political ideology, that folks like the Russians seek to do us harm and seek to sow the very divisive rhetoric that's happening today, we stand no chance at saving the republic. If, on the other hand, we can come to set together and say, listen, we'll have policy disagreements and we'll see different futures and paths forward for the best and most prosperous free Florida, but we ought to at least begin with a conversation that says foreign adversaries meddling in our elections is a major problem. And the reality is, prior to the legislation we passed last year, and I was mocked for this, there were jokes made on the House floor by some of my colleagues across the aisle when I said that a Russian oligarch could fund and amend the Florida Constitution. And prior to that legislation, it was absolutely true. We still have work to do. But rest assured to that listener or anybody else, there is nothing more important to me than ensuring our sovereignty as a state. And that includes a geopolitical foe who seeks to do us harm meddling in our elections.
Representative, lots of phone calls here, some about the process, some about the particular question that is being asked by this proposed amendment, which still has to go through a lot of the vetting process, including verifying the over a million signatures that were collected and, of course, has to go through the state Supreme Court process. Let's begin with John in Miami Beach. John, you are on line 3 with Representative Grant. Thanks for calling into the roundup. Go ahead.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I think one of the main issue here is that this is such an effective way to drive a base to vote that, I mean, it's almost got to be here to stay. I mean, it was so effective in Michigan in 2018 by putting legalizing marijuana on there. They like doubled the young voter turnout, turned a state that went Trump to blue. It's just so effective. I just feel like it's here to stay, and it has good consequences sometimes and bad other. And it's, you know,
good or bad would depend upon your political persuasion, John. But when you're talking about here to stay, do you mean this process of having signature-driven ballot measures show up on fall elections, which can have some significant consequences in terms of legislative and executive branch results?
Yeah, I think so. And yeah. I think there is a major risk, regardless of your view, of having some creepy force, some outside force funding this. I mean, if there's no transparency, I think that is a real risk. And being laughed at on the floor sounds, you know, that's a real thing.
Yeah, John,
definite real thing.
Thanks for joining the conversation here from Miami Beach.
Here's a tweet for you, Representative Grant from Jackson. This proposal is simply another dog whistle. The Florida Constitution already states that only citizens can vote. What's your reaction to that? That, you know, the perception around this, that this isn't about ensuring only citizens vote. It's more about driving perhaps President Trump's supporters to the polls next year to make sure he takes Florida in 2020. What do you think?
I'm incredibly troubled and discouraged by some of the rhetoric that we see assuming intentions or motives on all sides of our political discourse. And I say that to say that the first and most troubling thing to me is what is happening to the Florida Constitution. So before we even get to somebody who believes that it's a dog whistle or somebody that's trying to stoke fear, and at the end of the day, hope and fear have always been the two things that people buy, whether it's a product or they place a vote. You have some candidates who choose to kind of focus on the fear side, and others like myself who like to focus on the hope side. I think where we get to a place in society that we label everybody a racist, we desensitize the rhetoric such that nobody is actually a racist. More offensive here to me is the question of what amount of political oxygen are we using on something that doesn't have legal effect? Will there be racists who support it? Sure. Will there be people who look at it and with a completely race-agnostic perspective say, gee, it makes sense to me that only citizens can vote? And they're not going to necessarily know that that's already the law. And I think that's what happens with these ballot amendments. One of the things people need to understand is that you could legally get the repeal of the First Amendment onto the Florida election ballot. The Supreme Court does not review the language for anything with respect to constitutionality or legal infirmities or mm-hmm. legal ambiguities. All they look at is, have you complied with the process, and does the language say what you said it should say? And I think we should take a posture that says people shouldn't be able to spend money to repeal the First Amendment because they don't like what the press is doing and they're going to try and gen turnout for a candidate, and then let us spend 2 years litigating, finding out that, no, in fact, the First Amendment is sovereign. It can't be repealed, regardless of what the voters thought. These ambiguous questions that lead to all sorts of chaos in the political process are predicated by both parties who do it around how do I gen up excitement to turn people out and, for a completely unrelated question.
Grant. Let me just quickly get one more caller on the air. It's Lori in St. Pete. Lori, you're on the air. Go ahead quickly. What's your question?
I'm wondering if he's then looking for a requirement of proof of citizenship when we try to vote.
Okay. That's something people are a little confused by this and what it would mean. What about her question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very fair question to say, hey, is this the SS asking me for my papers? I don't believe that that would actually be the impact here. What we have in Florida is a scenario where supervisors of election, when you show up to register to vote, you self-attest that you're an eligible voter. The supervisor does not actually check whether you're an eligible voter or not. What the supervisor does is place you on the rolls. The Secretary of State is in charge of ensuring the integrity of the voter rolls, that eligible voters are on them, ineligible voters are not. And so I don't think it is a scenario where somebody is being asked for citizenship papers when they show up at the polls. If we really go to the crux of the criticism, I think Amy's done a pretty good job in covering this and other issues mm-hmm. in Florida and kind of diving into the weeds. It's more a non-effect than anything.
Representative, hold on. We got to take a quick time out here, but we want to continue the conversation with Representative James Grant about the process to amend the Constitution in the state of Florida. Lots of calls about this particular question regarding citizen voting. 305-995-1800 as the Florida Roundup continues.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Lots of calls, emails, and tweets coming in here to the Roundup this Friday as we look at a move to amend the Florida Constitution to make sure that only citizens can vote. It's a secretive effort, and questions have been raised because it's already against the law for non-citizens to vote. We're continuing the conversation now, and Tom, lots of people on hold around the state wanting to weigh in on this.
Yeah, Republican State Representative James Grant is still with us. He represents parts of Tampa Bay. He's with us, rather Tampa. He's with us from our Tampa sister station, WUSF. Richard is listening in online in Seattle. Richard, you used to be a Florida resident, but now you moved to the other corner of the continent. Go ahead. What's your view on this?
Yes, well, I was a practicing attorney while I was in Florida. And it just so happens that on Seth Meyers' TV show last night, Michael Moore was on, and he said how he helped, and a lot of other people helped change Michigan going from red to blue by putting two amendments set forth, one on marijuana and one against gerrymandering. Both of these amendments were opposed by the Republicans. They couldn't get anything done by regular legislative means, so they put those petitions on the ballot. They all passed.
Right.
Michigan flipped.
Yeah, so we've heard this idea, Richard, that there can be a kind of partisan type ballot initiatives put on important ballots to try to swing a vote.
Right. But in
for
Florida,
turnout.
The Florida Supreme Court gets to rule on whether the amendment is misleading or in some way defective. I think if the Florida Supreme Court looks at both sets of languages and says this would not change our ruling on how we interpret it, that only citizens can vote, and consider it basically a fraudulent proposal.
Gotcha.
And not allow it on the ballot.
Richard, we got it. Thanks for that analysis. So let me put that to Representative Grant. This a proposed amendment, should it pass all the vetting process here in Florida, would essentially erase two words in the Florida Constitution that says every citizen can vote, and it would replace that by saying only a citizen can vote. Now, you as a lawmaker know that each and every word in the law is very, very important in terms of clarifying and interpretation. You had mentioned earlier the Supreme Court's not going to pass judgment on the merit of it, but as it vets this particular question, how do you think it would view?
Well, I think it's an important distinction to make, both when I talk about the merit, but also substance. So if I fully expect the Supreme Court to green light this language, because the language does exactly what it says it does. It changes from language that says every citizen, which is at least inclusive of every citizen, to language that says only a citizen. It does what it says it does. The Supreme Court doesn't make a substantive analysis. What I tried to do last year and intend to continue working on to get the full reforms is so that when voters go into the ballot, they have transparency to understand the impact and effect of what they're voting on. Because the reality is a lot of people are going to vote on this with all sorts of misconceptions. And in this case, I don't know that it has any legal significance whatsoever. So I don't expect an implementing bill or legislative chaos. But we could, you know, spend days talking about the number of times where there has been ambiguous or less than complete ballot initiative that then throws a question to the legislature to resolve. The Supreme Court's not doing a substantive analysis. They're just saying, does your language do what you said it did? I think that the Supreme Court ought to be doing more on the front end. Obviously, separation of powers matter, so I can't make them do that. But we're looking at different ways that we can pose questions to them. We have general purview to throw questions through the Attorney General over to the court. So we're looking at those reforms. But Richard's point is well taken, that if the court was empowered and the voter was given the result and the transparency, I think some of these shenanigans would stop.
And to that question, though, Representative, to empower the court to be able to rule on the merit, that is in the purview of the legislature.
Well, no. We don't have the ability to require the court by process. The review of language I could go off on a big tangent here, so let me try and be disciplined for a change and keep it tight.
Well, I guess the question would be this. Who set the current process that you're saying that the court cannot pass judgment on the merit, that process came from where?
Well, you have the process. Okay, so the process is legislative.
Right.
We cannot compel the court to issue an opinion or an order. So we cannot compel the Florida Supreme Court to issue an opinion on whether or not a proposed repeal, hypothetically, of the First Amendment is unconstitutional. We can sue as soon as it becomes law.
Sure. But the process for petition review is set up through the legislative process.
Correct. Got that it. Side is us. But when we get to the substance of the amendment or the legality of the amendment, that is not us, and we cannot
force
the court to act. And
Representative Grant, I've got a question for you. I'm going to quote for you from a recent editorial about this in the Tampa Bay Times. They express concern about how all of these thousands of voter petitions are being dumped in local supervisor of elections offices because so many more signatures are needed to get something on the ballot. That's due in part to the legislation that you got through the process. Now, let me quote here. This is an editorial. The real danger here, they say, is that voters do not know what special interest is providing the untraceable cash behind amendment drives such as Florida Citizen Voters. When is the Florida legislature going to do something about that? That, to me, is the more existential question, that if you have enough money and enough juice, you can get an amendment on the ballot in Florida and don't have to disclose who's funding it, what their true motivation is, and you can get it passed into law. So does the legislature have a role in cracking down on those types of efforts? And how could the legislature go about doing that?
Melissa, the reality is you and I absolutely agree on what you just said. It's the Tampa Bay Times who doesn't. It's the same Tampa Bay Times who called my initial legislation that had to be watered down to get something done in an effort to build compromise. My initial legislation targeted all of those things. And what the Tampa Bay Times called it was anti-democratic because they thought it was about issues rather than the principle of the Constitution. Now that their editorial board has seen a constitutional amendment they don't like, all of a sudden they want transparency on who's collecting petitions, whether or not they were signed fraudulently. A lot of people don't realize we've actually had litigation in the state of Florida where things were passed by fraudulent petition collection, and the appellate court in that case, a gaming case, is the most salient. What the court said was, well, there's nothing we can do, even though it was put on the ballot fraudulently. It's already been passed by the voters, so we're going to let it go, setting a precedent.
Right, but that, you know what? That doesn't really answer my question. My question.
No, you and I agree. I've posed legislation.
But you're saying that couldn't pass into law?
No, I think it can now.
You would have to disclose who's funding these types of measures, that there would have to be more transparency.
Yeah, Melissa, you and I agree absolutely. Here's what I would say, and I think those who know me well know that I'm not real good at, nor do I lean towards the politics. I happen to agree with our founders that two parties are a death of a republic at some point. The reality is the Senate Democrats made every procedural motion they could make to obstruct my initial legislation coming up in the Senate. Had my initial legislation passed, we would have provided transparency on everything you just described. So here's my hope. Mm-hmm. My hope is that my initial instinct that the Democrats would join me in working to preserve the Florida Constitution from dark money, whether it's liberal money, conservative money, progressive money, or any other type of money, to look at the Florida Constitution and say the Florida Constitution shouldn't be a place where political shenanigans are played to drive electoral results by manipulating voters with ambiguous or misleading or even non-impactful language whatsoever. I think what we've seen over the last month is
let me just jump in because there are so many folks tweeting and calling the show, Representative. Let me just get a little bit of feedback to you coming in. Here's a tweet from Lorraine. A constitutional amendment to say something that is already there smacks of political shenanigans. Current elected officials need to speak out on this. And we're so fortunate to have Representative Grant on the show talking about this. Lots of callers all over the state. What are your questions about this proposed citizens' amendment? Aaron is in Suwannee. Hi, Aaron. How are you? Go ahead.
Fine. Thank you. I'm a younger voter. I'm in my mid-30s, and I'm sitting here starting to think this is just another dog and pony show to distract the masses from the really important issues. Like, let's say, climate change, you know, if the sea levels rise, bye-bye Miami, or the simple fact I'm driving a car with fossil fuel in it. Let me think. Ooh, we're about to run out, and we want to talk about putting something else in the Constitution that says, you know, if you're not a citizen, you can't vote. It's a dog and pony show because it's a hot button issue that's easy to get people all wrapped up about, and then they forget the important things that are going to kind of maybe kill millions of people. I don't know.
All right, Aaron, thanks for that. Representative Grant, does this take people's eye off the ball about what's really important to the future of Florida?
To the extent it takes the eye off the ball, it does in fact do this. It moves us further away from a republic and closer to a direct democracy. The beauty of a republic is that if my constituents don't like the things I'm working on or the votes I've taken or the pieces of legislation that I'm proposing, they should fire me. The proper recourse to change policy in a republic is through the legislative process. To the extent that people in both parties, out of state, in state, big money, little money, grassroots, grass tops, want to use the Constitution as a distraction away from other things, or to try and make law around the legislature and end a republic, you'll find no bigger champion than myself to agree that that's not the way that changes and policy and tough decisions should be made. We're always going to have to deal with tough issues. That's what we signed up for. We should be doing that in the legislative chamber, and we should be held accountable by our constituents, our voters, in a republic.
What we've experienced, though, in the state of Florida just recently, for instance, are voter-driven ballot amendments for measures that they were unsatisfied for the response from the legislature. I'm thinking, for instance, of the environmental money amendment in 2014 that earmarked a certain amount of money for environmental and land protection and set-asides. I'm thinking about the medical marijuana piece of legislation. I'm thinking about the restoration of rights, for instance, Representative.
Yeah, I mean, in all three of those cases, they're phenomenal use cases. The Amendment 1 with the public land stuff, you had people campaigning to say that that money would be required to buy public land. The language very clearly did not say that, right? So you have a scenario where people are pushing these amendments. They're suggesting that they say something or mean something that the very clear language of them does not mean. Medical marijuana, same thing. When you have language that says you shall not smoke inside, that leaves a question. Is smokable part of the amendment? Is smokable not part of it? Amendment 4 was probably the most grotesque we've ever seen with the restoration of rights, in the sense that the language itself identified probation. And then you had people who said, if the definition of terms of sentence is consistent with what the proponent said to get it on the ballot, if what they said to get the voters to vote for it, and then they explicitly call out probation, which is a financial obligation. And if you dive into the criminal justice world, oftentimes some of the grossest abuses of our returning citizens are in that probation cost of supervision world. They said any financial obligations, a poll tax. Well, they voted for a poll tax if that's the case, because the language put in front of them said this financial obligation, among others, has to be included.
Some critics of how the legislature has dealt with these amendments after the fact will point out, however, that the legislature has finally dealt with those issues, driven by some of the vagaries that you've identified in the language. If it were not for the citizen amendments, the ballot measures, those policies may not have been tackled by the legislature.
I think there's a difference between tackled and passed, Tom, and it's a fair point. But okay. But look at restoration of rights. One of my Tallahassee roommates, Cord Byrd, had filed a complete restoration of rights issue, which is where I am on that issue. We were working on that before Amendment 4 was ever put on the ballot. It didn't pass. There wasn't the groundswell behind it. The distinction I would make is the groundswell ought to be around legislation and holding legislators accountable, not doing an end run around. If there was as much passion and money and support and talking and campaigning around Cord Byrd's attempt to start with a full restoration of rights to look at the actual dignity of the returning citizen, not just voting, but all of their rights, that was tackled long before Amendment 4 was put on the ballot.
Okay.
And so I think it's fair that people would look on the outside, maybe not paying close enough attention, and I don't expect everybody to know every bill that's been filed, but we tackle things. They just kind of die in a vacuum sometimes. We know that it takes a couple years to generate this.
We've got to leave it there, but we appreciate your time today. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
James Grant, Representative Republican from Tampa Bay, with us here on the Florida Roundup. Guardians are part of a safety net designed to help Florida's children, elderly, and those too sick to make medical or financial decisions for themselves.
But the Florida Department of Law Enforcement is now investigating whether one of these court-appointed caretakers should face criminal charges for signing a do not resuscitate order, or a DNR, for a man who actually didn't want one, and that man later died. As this scandal has mushroomed, now Governor Ron DeSantis is calling for state agencies to take a very close look at Florida's guardianship program.
There's going to be action taken, whether it's administratively or legislative or a combination, because I think something needs to be done.
The governor's statements on Wednesday this week, also on the heels of this month's abrupt resignation of the executive director of the state agency that oversees the guardianship program. Now, do you have experience with this guardianship program? Are you concerned about it? Maybe a loved one has been involved with this. Perhaps you're also considering having a do not resuscitate order. Questions about DNRs. What are they? How are they used? Let us know here as we talk about the safety net for seniors and others in the state of Florida. 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800. Or send us a tweet at Florida Roundup. The Orlando Sentinel has extensively covered this issue. Jeff Weiner is the editor for the paper's Justice and Safety team. He joins us from our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. Jeff, welcome to the Florida Roundup. What can you tell us about this case of this one individual guardian and how she was operating with folks that essentially were under her care?
Right. So Rebecca Fairley, who's this Orlando-based guardian, but who had cases in a number of Central Florida counties, came under scrutiny after the family member of a man, the daughter of a man named Stephen Stryker, filed a complaint back in early May, saying that she had basically discovered that Stryker was under a DNR, as you mentioned, a do not resuscitate order that he did not want. Soon after that complaint was filed, he died, and the hospital would later tell state investigators that they could not perform life-saving measures on him to try to save his life because of that DNR order. And that order not only had not been approved by him, and he was adamantly opposed to it, it had not been approved by the court, which would have been the standard procedure. There are circumstances under which a guardian could, can take many different types of actions on the behalf of a ward, mm-hmm. but normally with court approval. So these investigations were launched. They soon discovered that this was a fairly standard practice of this guardian. We don't know exactly how common it was because you have to track down both the intent of the ward and what was done in each of these individual cases over many counties. But the end result was that Fierro was removed. In Orange County alone, she was forced to resign from 95 cases that she was handling and has had to drop out of dozens more in a bunch of other counties and circuits as this investigation has kind of spiraled. So it basically, we're not sure how many people are affected, but what I can tell you is that many people have come forward to us after we started reporting on this to say either that they're under her guardianship and don't know if there was a DNR placed on them, or that they found out, after our reporting, after the story came out, that there was.
Shows the value of great reporting. It's 305-995-1800 as we continue speaking with Jeff Weiner of the Orlando Sentinel. Call us up. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville as we continue talking about issues with Florida's guardianship program and potential security threats for the state's seniors. Jeff Weiner, the editor for the Orlando Sentinel's Justice and Safety team, is with us from WMFE in Orlando. And calls coming in from around the state, we'll go to them in a moment at 305-995-1800. And you know, Jeff, here in Florida, a story like this is particularly painful to learn about given our large senior population. Mm-hmm. This is so disturbing for seniors and their loved ones to learn about. People wondering if their parent or grandparent is safe. Now, as you report, what you've discovered is that the state apparently lacks adequate enforcement powers to make sure that professional guardians are doing what they should. Can you tell us a little bit more about some holes in the system? What's really happening with that?
Yeah, I think the core of what we've been finding is that once someone is placed under guardianship, which can happen under a number of circumstances, including they wind up in the hospital and can't remember the name of a family member and no one can get in touch with their loved ones. Once you wind up in guardianship and a court has decided that you're incompetent to make your decisions, it's very difficult to get a person out of that situation, even if they improve. And in addition to that, the oversight of professional guardians, of which there are about 550 in the state, is mostly run in kind of a piecemeal fashion. There is is a state organization called the Office of Public and Professional Guardians that was formed fairly recently, which has a very small staff and not much funding and basically has a big backlog of investigations. You know, last year alone, according to their annual report, there are 130 cases where they determined that there was a legal basis for a complaint, but only one guardian was actually, you know, lost their ability to be a guardian over that. So what we're finding is that the system is very, very reliant on the guardian themselves being, you know, an ethical person who's behaving in the interest of the ward. And when that breaks down, it can be difficult for the judge to detect it. There's not a whole lot of oversight, not a whole lot of communication.
Wow. So on the honor system, that is really fascinating to hear and certainly concerning for so many Florida families. Meanwhile, we've got a lot of calls about this. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Colleen in Boca Raton. Hi, Colleen. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. Well, I think, you know, if you really speak with a lawyer, many people don't understand what NP, you know, that do not resuscitate actually means. It's supposed to be at the end of a terminal illness. Whatever you have is going to take you out eventually. So, but it could be a five-year thing, and if you slip and fall and hit your head hard enough that you need to be resuscitated, you don't use it in those situations. And I think that's where some people don't really understand. My wish is that when I'm at the end of a terminal illness or I am brain dead, et cetera, yes, please don't resuscitate me. But also what we've done with all of our loved ones is whatever hospital is closest to us, we have our wishes on file. And mm-hmm. I think that's one thing that many people don't do.
Colleen, you're so right, and it's so important that people do that and make their wishes known to their loved ones and put them in writing. And Jeff, what about her comments? You know, as I read your story and learned about this, it sort of makes one understand why a senior citizen might be reluctant to allow a DNR to be written in their name. They're concerned about how the process might unfold.
Yeah, I think the caller is absolutely right that the best protection you can have for yourself and your loved ones is to have your wishes very explicitly laid out in writing and ahead of time before you're in a situation where it might need to be applied. You know, in these cases, we have, you know, situations where people were, you know, are adamantly telling us, you know, I did not want to be under a DNR either, you know, with regard to my condition or with regard to anything. But because there was nothing already in place because they wound up in a facility, you know, at a point where they were already declared incompetent, they had really no control over that process, which kind of underscores the amount of power that a legal guardian, a professional guardian can have. You know, once they take control of your, you know, once they basically assume your rights, they can sell your property. You could, you know, your house that you've lived in for generations could be sold. You know, all of your belongings could be sold if they decide that that's what's the correct thing to happen for you. You know, medical decisions, end of life decisions, you know, pretty much anything. You know, we had one man that we spoke to who, you know, had money to his name, but was basically forced to live off of like a biweekly $125 Publix gift card because the guardian determined that that was what was best for him. And he was someone who, if you talk to him, was very lucid, very capable of explaining what he wanted, but he became, you know, a ward of the state. And at that point, what he could do to resist what was going on to him was pretty limited.
Jeff, what's the recourse for family members that may have an elderly relative under guardianship for them to go through, to see the file, to make sure everything is in order the way that it is supposed to be in order, that there's nothing missing from the file, but there's also nothing been added without their knowledge?
Well, you know, you can, if you have a family member who's under guardianship and you don't believe should be, it is possible to petition the court to have basically a determination hearing to decide whether the person is still incompetent. Other than that, the main advice that, you know, seems to emerge from this for now, at least, is vigilance and communication, getting in touch with any facility that oversees the person. You know, if you believe that your loved one is being mistreated, there's a hotline where you can report elder abuse. Being in touch with the loved one, you know, talking to the guardian as much as possible, asking for documentation of decisions that have been made, and anything that you're not able to get, obviously, is a subject of concern. But because of that kind of, overtaxed enforcement arm that we talked about, there isn't a lot of, you know, really powerful response that you can have.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. DeRose is calling from Miami. Hi, DeRose. Thanks for calling. You're on the radio. You're on the roundup. Go ahead.
DeRose. Yeah, I'm going on a slightly different topic. I'm a father of a son who has some disabilities. I'm his guardian. And every year I've got to go back to the court and spend a couple hundred dollars through my lawyer. Very nice man. And I have to pay this money every year. He said, I'm still his guardian. Can anybody, should we do it every, could there be a form I could fill out, present to the court, I'm still a stay in mind, la, 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 la. Pretty good question that I could make up a form and let us avoid having to go to a lawyer. I mean, this makes lawyers rich. I'm not against the lawyers getting rich. not against that at all.
Right, yeah. But do you really need a lawyer for this? Yeah, I hear your point there. Jeff, you know, that's one example. I think that we could probably find a lot of other ones of all the burden that families have to go through in terms of the bureaucracy, the cost, the paperwork, when they're in this situation with their senior relative or friend or loved one.
Yeah, it can be a very difficult situation and a system to navigate. And, you know, I mean, I'm glad that he mentioned, you know, the potential for a family member to be a guardian. That is the most common circumstance mm-hmm. under which someone becomes under guardianship is with their family and loved ones. And in that case, you know, at least the person who's overseeing them, knows what kind of what their desires and wishes were. You know, so I could understand the caller wanting to streamline that process a bit. You know, the people who someone like Rebecca Fearley comes under over control of is more likely to be someone who does not have that close familial connection, who's watching out for them, and therefore, you know, is potentially more at risk for not having their wishes respected.
Hannah in Melbourne is on line six. Hannah, thanks for calling in. Your thoughts on this?
So my question is, when you guys were mentioning earlier that she has 95 separate cases with the elderly, is there any type of Florida legislation or regulations that apply? Because that really seems like that's a lot of people for her to be managing as one person. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. And Jeff, you mentioned 95 with this particular guardian in Central Florida of people where the court really kind of was looking at the kind of work she was doing. Her caseload was larger than that even, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. 95 was just in Orange County. And she was in more than 10 counties that had cases, not that many in most counties. She was mostly based out of Orlando.
Is that custom to have that kind of caseload?
I couldn't tell you whether it's customary, but there is not a cap on it. So for a professional guardian, it's basically however many you can take on. And, you know, those 95 were just the open cases that she had in Orange County. She had been involved in, I think, the comptroller's report said about 400 in recent years in Orange County alone. And in Seminole County, there were about 82 cases, but some of those were duplicative where there was one ward who was involved in more than one case. So we don't know exactly how many she had there, but those are just two counties, and she was operating in many in our area.
And as we mentioned, the state has launched an investigation kind of here into this office. Hannah's question, could that result in some legislation?
Certainly it could. You know, I mean, we're still waiting to hear exactly what kind of, you know, what the scope of that investigation is going to be and what kind of recommendations it might produce. But this case has certainly brought light to the fact that, you know, this office is not producing many investigations compared to the amount of complaints that it's getting, you know. And we know, for example, from sources that before she resigned, Carol Berkowitz, the former director of the agency, had been consistently complaining about not having enough resources to pursue the office's mission, not having the money that they needed to track down these complaints, which, you know, in fairness, is a very complicated process. It involves, you know, a lot of interviews and tracking down records and probably, you know, travel and documentation. It's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, at least in the opinion of the person who was until recently running it, the OPPG just did not have the money that they needed to do that.
And that's typical of a lot of programs that are put in place, isn't it? Right, Jeff, to protect the most vulnerable citizens, whether it's seniors, children, the disabled. This is not an unusual state of affairs, unfortunately,
for
Florida. And so we, you know, we really want to thank you for your reporting on this. I'd encourage everyone to read Jeff's work and his colleagues in the Orlando Sentinel as this investigation unfolds into how guardianship is affecting Florida's senior citizens. Jeff Wiener, editor for the Sentinel's Justice and Safety Team, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director. The Director of Radio Operations at WLRN is Peter Meritz. Engineering help coming from Doug Peterson and Charles Michaels. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday at noon. Have a great weekend.